Okay, thanks a lot. And well, first of all, thanks to Latham and to Enrique for inviting me here. And thank you all for coming. It's always a pleasure to be here. So indeed, that would be about causality. And that's a joint program we started with Nicolas Franco, and now more recently also with Tomek Miller from Warsaw. Right, so let me start with a bit of motivation and intro. So the principle of causality is usually regarded as one of the fundamental ingredients that should have, that any physical theory should have. So basically, that's a postulate. Well, that's a consequence of Einstein's postulate, saying that the speed of light should be constant and frame independent. Now, it has some riveting consequences, in particular the existence of horizons in black hole solutions or in cosmological ones. And on the mathematical side, well, it's conveniently implemented with the help of Lorentzian geometry with an indefinite metric. Now, that's about classical physics. Now, if you go quantum, things are getting more complicated. And well, at the very beginning, there were some controversies around the existence of entangled states and their relationship to the principle of causality, as expressed by the famous Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paradox. Well, then people realize that that's not quite the same thing. And although there are entangled states, you cannot use them to transfer information superluminally. And that's expressed by the quantum information theorems like no cloning, no signaling, no broadcasting, and so on. So the lesson is that non-locality does not necessarily mean causality violation. Now, if you want to reconcile causality with quantum theory, well, if you want to do it completely, you have to go to quantum field theory. And that's expressed by the microscopic causality axiom, which says that the algebras of observables, of local observables, related to space-like separated regions should commute. All right, so but there's a general belief that there should be some fine structure of space-times at small scales. But you cannot access it directly, because if you would attempt to make a too precise measurement, well, then you would have to pump too much energy in a small region of space-time, and that would lead to a black hole formation, and your information would eventually be trapped. So this also means that events do not have an operational meaning. You cannot access a space-time event directly. It's always somewhere hidden. So this is sometimes expressed in saying that, well, this means that the space-time coordinates do not commute. And this is what people usually call a non-commutative space-time. Now, but this notion has several conceptual problems, rather severe ones. Well, firstly, what are the notions of space and time? Well, that's not only a philosophical question. That's also about practical things, because you want to have some evolution, for instance, distributions and things like that. Now, second thing is what happens with the space-time geometry? Because in the classical setting, we have a nice geometry, some smooth structure, some curvature, and things like that. So what happens at the quantum level then? And finally, how to establish a quantum field theory on such a beast? And for that, in particular, you need to understand what happens with the notion of causality. So the viewpoint I want to advocate during my talk is an operational viewpoint on physics, which is the one adopted in quantum information theory. So you regard your physical system as consisting of states and observables. So observables are just some measurable physical quantities. Okay, and if you look at these quantities, the apparatus, how they behave, well, you discover that, okay, for instance, you can rescale your measuring apparatus, or you can concatenate them, and you will still get another apparatus. So this leads you to a structure of an associative algebra. And this algebra turns out to have a natural norm topology, and at the end, you end up with a C-star algebra. So that's a very nice example of a topological algebra. Now, that's observables. On the other hand, you have states of the system, which are just positive linear functionals on your algebra of norm one. So if you take an observable, you evaluate it on some state, then what you get is an expectation value of your observable in this state omega. And actually, once you have all of the observables, you have the algebra, then the states are, you can define what's the space of states. You can just compute it. And you discover one thing, that it's a convex set. So it has extremal points. And these extremal points, you call them pure states. OK, and that's a very general setting in which you can formulate classical physics. Then you have commutative algebras of observables. You can do quantum mechanics, phase space, for instance. With a bit of more effort, you can do also quantum field theory with a net of local algebras, things like that. OK, so now comes the question, what is a space in this setting? And to understand that, you have to go back to classical physics. And in classical physics, you know that all of your observables, they are commutative. Commutative sister algebras are always functions on some topological space, be that a space-time or phase space or whatever else you wish. And here you can use Gelfand duality. You say that, well, it turns out that all of the pure states of this algebra, they are in one-to-one correspondence with the points of your space. And that's the famous Gelfand duality, or the Gelfand-Neimark theorem. So you say that you can regard the evaluation of a function at a point P, so the value of A at a point P, just as an evaluation functional, which takes a function and gives you a value. Okay, so that's this kind of duality. And that's also topological. So the topology of X, you can recover it from the weak star topology of this space of pure states. Okay, so that would be my proposal. So a non-commutative space for me would be the space of pure states of a non-commutative C-star algebra of certain observables. OK, but that's very nice, but that's only topology. And now we know very well that in all interesting cases, this space X, for instance, the space-time, has some intrinsic geometry, some smooth structure, metric structure, causal structure, and so on. So the big question is there geometry beyond the classical, means the commutative setting? The answer is positive, and it's called non-commutative geometry. But it's quite abstract, and it needs some serious mathematics. OK, so let's first start with some remarks on causality, just the classical causality. So what's a causality for a mathematician? So I have a PhD in mathematics, so I have this viewpoint. Well, for mathematicians, this is just a partial order relation on a space-time, which is induced by the Lorentzian metric. There's just some partial order on the space of events. It is defined as follows. So we say that Q, event Q, is to the future of the event P. If and only if there exists a future-directed causal curves that gets you from P to Q, or P equals Q. That's natural. With the help of this notion, you can cook up some nice functions on your space-time, namely the causal functions. So you just define them in the following way. So you take a real-valued function on a manifold, which is non-decreasing on every future-directed causal curve. So symbolically, this means that whenever Q is to the future of P, then A of Q should be greater or equal than A of P. Okay, if any one of you knows a bit about mathematical relativity, that's very similar to the concept of a time function, which is strictly increasing on every future-directed causal curve. So that's if you have a stably causal space-time, for instance, then you have a notion of a global time, so that every observer that moves along a causal curve can somehow they have a common time function, right? So that's similar. That's a slightly weaker notion. OK, and what are these causal functions good for? Well, they are good for recovering the causal order, because you can turn this implication the other way around. And if you have a causally simple spacetime, which is somewhere between stably causal and globally hyperbolic, so with a sufficiently robust causal structure, then you can recover the causal order by saying that Q is to the future of P, if and only if for all bounded causal functions, you have this inequality. Okay, well, it's sufficient to take bounded causal functions. It's sufficient also to take smooth because they are dense. Okay, so that's again a manifestation of this duality between the functions and the points, states, things like that. All right. So, what is it good for? Because for the moment, we have defined a causal function using causal curves, and then we got the other way around. So that's nice, but I mean, so what? So the gain is the following. If you recall the Gelfand duality, you know that the pure states of this commutative algebra correspond to the events in your spacetime. So how about the mixed states on this algebra? Because there are a lot of mixed states. Here you have the Ries representation theorem, which says that mixed states on this algebra are, in fact, Borel probability measures on your spacetime. So this kind of non-local events. And you can see that, well, the pure states here, these will just be the Dirac deltas, which are, again, Borel probability measures. So with the help of the causal functions, we can propose the following definition. That's what we did with Tomek in 2015. So if you have a causally simple spacetime, and you take two, this will stand for Borel probability measures on a spacetime, you can say that the measure nu is to the future of a measure mu, if and only if, for all bounded causal functions, we have this inequality of the integrals. So if you have Dirac deltas here, then you just recover the previous result. But, well, and this is a nice partial order relation on this space of Borel probability measures. So we found out that the causal order on the spacetime naturally extends to all mixed states, all possible non-local phenomena on your spacetime. So what's the intuition behind this notion? Well, you can reformulate it equivalently by saying that, well, measure nu is to the future of a measure mu if and only if there exists a joint measure such that mu and nu are left and right marginals of this measure, respectively, and such that the J plus, so the set of all causally related pairs of events, is a full measure set. Okay, and this is very much in the spirit of an optimal transport theory, which is the domain of mathematics that tell you how to move a pile of sand from one place to another, minimizing some cost function. So here our cost function is just, well, it's just zero whenever you can move something along causal curves, and it's infinite where you cannot do it. As simple as that. So it's about causally moving one pile of sand from one place to another. So therefore, this deserves the name of a causal transference plot or a causal coupling. If you have just Dirac measures, then the only coupling between two Dirac measures is just another Dirac measure on M square. And then this relation of deltas as measures is equivalent to the usual causal relation. And a remark is that this definition is actually more general than the previous ones. Namely, it makes sense in any space and not necessarily causally simple. Okay, so what's the physical picture behind it? Well, you have a coupling, which means that you have a family of curves that links the points in the support of one measure with points in the support of the other measure. And the requirement that J plus should be a full measure set means that all of these curves should be future-directed causal. Okay, so that's the picture, and that's the intuition that each infinitesimal part of the probability density should travel along a future-directed causal curve. It can be a time-like curve, it can be a null curve, but it always needs to be a causal curve. Okay, and well, let me point out that this infinitesimal parts of the density, they can bifurcate, so you can have curves starting at one point and reaching the other points, and they can also start from different points and end up at one point. So the general picture is quite messy. Also, this family is far from being unique, of course, but the causal coupling is unique, so that's the intuition behind it. Okay, so what it might be good for, say, an application? Well, obviously, if you have some probability measure, you can model classical quantities like, for instance, energy density or charge density or even dust. As long as you can normalize it, you have a probability measure. And then you can ask whether it evolves causally. But you can also do something a bit more elaborate, and you can go to wave packet formalism. As usually, people claim that you cannot speak about causality without going to quantum field theory. Well, we challenged this viewpoint to some extent, and we showed that, well, there is a sensible notion of causality in the wave packet formalism for just wave packets. So if you start with a Schrödinger equation with your favorite Hamiltonian, and you have the solutions of these, which give you the wave functions, and they yield a family of measures, well, Borel probability measures on spacetime, which are concentrated on the time slices. Okay, so here's the picture. So you have some initial wave packet, which then evolves and spreads, and then you cut it into slices like that. And at each time slice, well, you can cut it like that, you can cut it the other way around if you want, but at each time slice, you have a Borel probability measure, which is supported on this time slice, okay, and you have a whole family of that. So the sensible question you can ask, is this evolution causal? In the sense that if a measure precedes another in the evolution, is it causally related to it? And well, the answer is not obvious. It depends on the system. And just to give you a glimpse, for instance, if you take a Dirac Hamiltonian, then it will yield a causal evolution. But if you take a relativistic Schrödinger Hamiltonian, which is also invariant, so very nice, you won't get a causal evolution. And it does not depend whether you start with a compactly supported state or whether it's it has heavy tails. It's a rather generic result. OK, so if you want to see the details, you can just look at these papers or just ask me. I'm still here tomorrow. OK, so let's now move on to the second part of the talk. And so far, we looked at causality only from the commutative viewpoint. So we had classical physics with some application to quantum physics, but we still had classical observables, classical algebras. And now we want to go quantum. So how are we going to do that? Well, to this end, we need some mathematics, and that's non-commutative geometry a la Kohn. So the basic objects of this theory are so-called spectral triples. So the first ingredient you already know, that's a sister algebra. Well, technically, some dense subalgebra of it. You need a Hilbert space on which you can always represent your algebra in terms of bounded operators. And then the third ingredient, which gives you the actual geometry, is a so-called Dirac operator. And that's a certain unbounded operator acting on this Hilbert space, which should have bounded commutators with all elements of the algebra. Okay, so this condition, well, this thing here, this commutator, basically tells you how to differentiate your elements of the algebra. So it establishes a differential calculus on this non-commutative sister algebra. Okay, and well, there is, of course, a bit more behind these definitions. There are some technical assumptions, which I don't want to list here. And there's some additional structure you can put on it. You can consider some modules, which would correspond to vector bundles. You can have some chirality operators, so you can do chiral theories. You can have charge conjugation, et cetera, et cetera. So somehow the viewpoint here is that you can transfer the geometry from the Schrödinger, say, space picture, space-time picture, to the Heisenberg picture. So in Heisenberg picture, you start with a non-commutative algebra. And if you have a spectral triple, you have some geometry governed by the Dirac operator. So at the Schrödinger level, you would have some non-commutative space, or space-time, with some intrinsic geometry, which is governed by this Dirac operator. OK. So why is it a nice structure and probably the good one? Well, that's attested by the famous Kohn's reconstruction theorem, which says that whenever you have a commutative spectral triple with a commutative algebra, then there always exists a smooth, compact spin Riemannian manifold such that the algebra is just the algebra of smooth functions over this manifold. The Hilbert space is the Hilbert space of square summable sections of the spinner bundle. So we have spinners. It takes sections of the bundle because it can be curved in general. So we have a bundle. And this gives you a Hilbert space. And the Dirac operator, well, that's the one you know from physics. If you have a flat spacetime, you have just d mu here. If you have something curved, then you need to add a spin connection here. OK, so that's, you can look at this theorem as a very far-reaching generalization of the Gelfand duality, which tells you that not only you can transfer topology, but also you can transfer geometry to the, say, to the Heisenberg picture, if you want.
I think you're, yeah. OK. I know that's the usual things that people say, but you're hiding something there, which is you're hiding something in what you call technicality, isn't it? And it's, I don't think it's a technicality. So if you rewind back, you know, in Cohn's axioms, what's very important is that you don't have one representation. You have two representations, the left and the right, and they commute. And they are distinct, right?
Yes.
And that's it's very important in the structure that there is these two distinct representations. When you go to this commutative triple, you only have one representation. So it's strictly speaking a commutative. So it's not really true that, you know, you need to have a degeneration. So you would say a commutative geometry is something where it's not only a triple, but it's a triple with a specific relationship between the left and the right. And that's where the geometry is. The geometry enters this relationship between the left and the right. And this kind of reconstruction theorem is, so therefore, you know, I would challenge that. I think this is really a weak point of the whole program. Is that it's forgetting this, the fact that space is, in some sense, a subset of your algebra. It's not the whole algebra. I think it's a very, very, very important point for how you're going to generalize all the other notions. That could be completely overlooked.
Can you repeat what you said in the microphone?
Sorry?
Can you repeat his question?
Yeah, OK, so the question, that was more of a remark. So I completely agree that there's, well, this theorem actually took on some 12 years to prove it. And it has a long list of assumptions, which are hidden exactly in this technical assumptions
but
here.
They are not technical assumptions. That was my point. This is very, very important conceptual differences.
Yes, but also the point is that if you want to construct non-commutative examples, you usually abandon them. I mean, no one, not necessarily this double representation thing,
no,
but
the double. You're talking the fact that you're.
Yeah. Okay, but
in Cohn's axioms, it's very important that you have a left representation and a right representation. So it's not like an irreducible representation of an algebra. It's you really have two representations that commute. And this interplay is at the core of most of the property.
That's also to some extent motivated by the Tomita Takasaki theory. So there's
Which has to do with time. So if you talk about time, you have to talk about Tomita Takasaki. So
well. Okay. Anyway, that's
is this unique? More of a, there exists a unique smooth compact spin manifold?
Yes.
One, a unique?
Yes. Yes. I mean, you have a, well, there is a unique Riemannian metric on it. So that's unique. Yeah. Maybe let me, because then I will go to my personal viewpoint on that. And I will more, because I'm more interested in the space of state. I think that's where the geometry should be really defined. And I will be using spectral triples as a tool to define a geometry there. So that's maybe not completely equivalent, but that's a maybe different viewpoint on physics. Anyway, let me proceed. So let me just give you examples. So what are the other examples of spectral triples? Well, you can have finite spectral triples, so you take any your favorite matrix algebra represented on a Hilbert space. You take any self-adjoint matrix on this Hilbert space, and that's a nice Dirac operator you can use. You can have direct sums and tensor products of spectral triples, and you again get a spectral triple. Well, an important example of a tensor product spectral triple is the one called almost commutative geometry. So if you take a commutative spectral triple, you tensor it with a finite spectral triple, then you get something almost commutative, because this one is infinite dimensional and the other guy is finite. So that's almost commutative. And you can have much more. You can describe fractals, some deformations, Moyal planes, quantum groups, quantum spaces, Kappa-Minkowski, things like that. Okay, so for me, one of the drawbacks of Kohn's theory is hidden here in the word Riemannian. And this theorem really works only for Riemannian manifolds with positive definite metric. And if you want to do physics, and in particular if you're interested in causality, you need to have a Lorentzian setup. Okay, so there is a proposal for something which is called the Lorentzian spectral triples. And well, that's a very new theory and that's rapidly developing. But okay, let me give you the somehow the main conceptual ingredient that you need to put. And well, the basic idea is that if you go Lorentzian, you want to deal with indefinite products. In a Hilbert spaces, you have only positive definite product. So to handle this, you can use a Krein space, which is just a vector space with an indefinite non-degenerate inner product, such that it splits into the part on which this product is positive and the part on which this product is negative. And well, it's zero on off diagonal. And both these spaces are Hilbert spaces with respect to this product, so they are intrinsically complete.
Do you have any restriction on the signature? The size of this plus and minus?
No, that's any pseudo-Riemannian thing can be.
Okay, so it's not Lorentzian?
No, it's not Lorentzian. It's pseudo-Riemannian. It's more general.
So you're going to specialize?
Sorry? Sorry?
Is there a definition maybe you're going to put that applies to a Lorentzian subset of Krein space?
Oh, well, that's actually a difficult problem, how to get the correct signature from the theory. I would say that you have something Lorentzian whenever you can define causality, but that will come out late. For the moment, the theory is that you can do pseudo-Riemannian spectral triples with whatever signature you wish. Well, you can certainly do it bottom-up, starting with a space and building a spectral triple. And then if you want to recover it, that's more tricky. We don't have a reconstruction theorem, nothing close to it. That's more of a conceptual foundation for the moment. In any case, you have this Krein space, and you have this decomposition, which is non-unique, of course. You can have a lot of different decompositions in one Krein space. But once you pick up one, you can have it's called a fundamental symmetry operator, which is just identity here and minus identity here. And with the help of this operator, you get a Hilbert space structure and a positive definite product on this Krein space. So you can either look at a Krein space as a space with an indefinite product, which you can turn to a Hilbert space, or you can look at it as a Hilbert space with an additional operator that gives you an indefinite product. Well, the good thing...
And this operator should commute with the Dirac operator?
No. No, it won't. Okay, let me give you the example, and you see it's... It doesn't
in
commute
the case
with
where
it.
We have a weak rotation, it's because we have isometries. So it's because we have commutation of the Hamiltonian with the big compatibility condition.
I think nobody understands here the question, so that's
what?
Nobody understands what you are saying.
I'm talking about when you have a weak rotation, you need to have a symmetry, so there needs to be compatibility between the dynamics, and I was asking whether you have any condition of compatibility between the Dirac operator and the
Well, there is some condition. Compatibility condition, but it's not commutation. It's anti-commutation, in fact.
Or anti-commutation.
Yeah, it's anti-commutation. Okay, let me give you the example shortly. Just let me mention that although you have this non-uniqueness here, but the Hilbert space structure is unique in the sense that all of the norms that result from these different positive scalar products are equivalent. So you have a unique notion of operators on the Krein space, which are just the operators on the associated Hilbert space. So that's a good thing. And now an example, if you have a space and time oriented pseudo-Riemannian manifold, whatever signature, spin Riemannian manifold, then this space, the L2 sections of a square integrable sections of a spinner bundle, that's a Krein space. That's a result of Helge Baum. And okay, concretely, if you take psi dagger psi, then you have something positive definite because that's probability. Your fundamental symmetry operator is gamma zero. So you see it anti-commutes with the Dirac. And the indefinite inner product is just psi bar psi. Okay, that's the indefinite one that you know from the action.
Okay, so yeah? But psi dagger psi is not the scalar. So how can you integrate it over all of space-time? It's like a component of the spin or bilinear corresponding to a four vector. Simply the zero.
Oh, but it's a.
Seems not right.
So it's a function, right?
It's not invariant.
Yes. Of course, it's not invariant. But okay. Well, that's the invariant product. And that's the point. So we have the natural structure of this space is a Krein space structure with an indefinite product, which is invariant. But you can turn it to have a Hilbert space product. But yes, of course, you lose Lorentz invariance here. So the Lorentzian spectral triple or a pseudo-Riemannian spectral triple, well, you take the algebra as it is because that's only topology. You take a Krein space. And you take a Dirac operator. And again, in the classical case, you can just take the Riemannian Dirac operator. That's all works fine. So let me again stress that doesn't have such a nice structure as the usual spectral triples. And there's a lot of technical problems with this Dirac operator. But nevertheless, for causality, we only need the bounded commutators with the Dirac. And that's guaranteed. Okay, so let's get back to causality. So recall that we have these causal functions, so non-real valued functions over the manifold, which are non-decreasing on future-directed causal curves, right? So now the question is how to identify these functions as elements of the algebra without resorting to this notion of future-directed causal curves. And that's a result with proof with Nicolas, is that if you have a commutative Lorentzian spectral triple, so basically something that you build up from a Lorentzian manifold, okay, then a function is causal if and only if this commutator with the Dirac operator is negative semi-definite with respect to this indefinite inner product on the Krein space. Okay, so in this way, we have a nice algebraic condition, what it means for a function to be causal. And well, now we can go non-commutative because we have something that does not depend on this notion of a curve and things like that. It's just purely algebraic. Okay, so to get the true partial order, we need to be sure that there's enough of these causal functions. So we need to choose a unitization of the algebra, but that's technicality. And then you consider a cone of elements which satisfy this condition, this initial condition. And then you need to be sure that there's enough of these causal functions to separate the points in the sense of Stone-Weierstrass theorem. It means that the causal functions should span the whole algebra when you close, because these are dense algebras, so we need to consider a C-star closure. And once you have such a causal cone, then you can define a partial order relation on the space of states, all states on this bigger algebra, and this a fortiori also on this space of pure states on this algebra, or space of mixed states on your initial algebra. And the definition is very simple, so you just say that chi is to the future of Xi is to the future of chi if and only if, for all causal elements, you have such an inequality. Okay, so we know that if we are in a commutative setting and we consider pure states, we are going to recover the usual causal relation. If we're going to take probability measures, we're going to get back to the notion of causality between probability measures we hooked up with Thomas.
So I have a question about this condition. If you go back to the usual old code algebra, the Riemannian one, and you apply this condition, is that a restriction on the A, or every operator causal in the Riemannian geometry, or what's?
Well, in the Riemannian geometry, you don't have this indefinite product, so.
No, but you.
So you need this indefinite product, but the analogy
D commutator A,
So there's
D positive or negative. That's what I'm saying. If you give me a random algebra element A, it's not always true that its expectation value.
Let me write the analogy for you. If you're in the Riemannian setting, then you can define a distance. That's the Kohn's distance between two states. And you take a supremum over all elements of the algebra of pi of a minus pi of a, of all elements of the algebra which have a norm of the commutator bounded by 1. That's called the Kohn's distance formula. And you can show that in the commutative case, it's just it recovers the geodesic distance between points of a Riemannian manifold. Okay, and here, so that's the analogy. If we now go to the Lorentzian setting, well, we don't have a norm. I mean, in the Lorentzian distance formula, you have an anti-Lipschitz functions rather than Lipschitz functions.
I thought what you were using is not the norm of the commutator. You're using the expectation value of the commutator. Am I correct? So the expectation value of the commutator can be positive and negative, even in the Riemannian algebra. So that's my question. Even in a Riemannian context, this is the restrictions on the sets of tails.
It's a condition for all phi.
What?
This is for all phi, so this is saying the commutator is negative semi-definite.
Yes, it's negative semi-definite, so it's...
It's
global, but
is that true? If you give that's the question. If you give me a Riemannian Kohn algebra, is it true that this product is negative semi-definite for every?
Well, in the Riemannian, you don't have this indefinite product, so I don't know how to address it. I mean,
maybe I don't understand.
If I have just a regular spectral triple Riemannian, I don't have an indefinite product. I mean, not any natural one.
Maybe I don't understand this condition. What do you mean by negative definite?
Well, that's precisely what is written here. So for any element of this Krein space, this indefinite inner product should be...
But that's what I'm saying is that even if the product is positive definite or negative definite, that object could be positive or negative. Maybe it's a stupid question. The expectation value of an operator could be positive or negative.
Yes, the expectation value, yes.
And that's the expectation value of the operator... DA.
Well,
it's just a question. It's just a question. Is it? You see the question?
I don't think so. I mean, I'm not sure what's the.
See why, if you give me a matrix algebra, any operator with a complete expectation value could be positive or negative, even if my algebra.
Yes, it could be positive. But that's not. No, it's about an operator being positive or negative semi-definite, right?
Or semi-definite, yes.
So, in other words, the negativity or semi-negativity of all of the eigenvalues, right?
Yeah, and
you can have
algebra operators which have, whose derivative commutative with the are sometimes positive and sometimes negative.
Yes, but
okay,
then there's.
Then
these elements are not causal. I mean, I would say that's a condition for an element to be causal, if this condition holds.
Yes,
okay.
So you have a notion of causality which also apply even in the Riemannian case.
No, because I don't have an indefinite product, so I don't know how to even write this condition.
By the same thing, write the product. To be
but I don't have an indefinite inner product.
It doesn't matter. I'm not sure.
But then, I mean...
Use the positive inner product and write that D of A expectation value is negative. That would be a restriction on your operators. What do you think?
Yeah, okay, you can do that, but... Okay. Yeah, maybe you can do that. But anyway, I haven't thought about it. I have no idea, no intuition about behind it. So, okay, let's stay Lorentzian for the moment. Okay. Okay, so I have this partial order relation on the space of states. Now, okay, so here's my proposal. How should one understand a non-commutative spacetime? Well, that should be the space of pure states of a non-commutative C-star algebra, which is equipped with a causal order determined by a pseudo-Riemannian spectral triple geometry. Okay, so let's move to a concrete example, which hopefully will motivate this abstract work. So let's go almost commutative. So let's do something only mildly non-commutative. So we take a commutative Lorentzian spectral triple, which we just construct from space-time. So nothing fancy here. And then we add some tiny non-commutative part, finite part. And then we take a tensor product. We have something almost commutative. Okay, and if you look at the space of pure states of this full algebra, then you will discover that it's just a direct product of the usual space-time component and some inner space of states, which is related to this finite algebra here. So that's somewhat in the Kaluza-Klein spirit, right? So we have again the space-time component and you have some internal component, but it has slightly different status here because it's not a really new dimension, but it's something really internal which is governed by the non-commutative part of this space. So one nice feature of this almost commutative space-times is the following. So there's no Einstein causality violation here. So if you want to, whenever you move in the space of states, you cannot break Einstein causality. So if two states are causally related, then the corresponding points in the space-time component are still causally related in the usual sense. But on the other hand, it turns out that this causality constraints, well, condition, it induces highly non-trivial constraint on the motion also in the internal space. So there's some boundary speed that you can reach also when you change your internal state. Okay, let me illustrate it on a very simple example. Namely, let's take just this algebra, just two copies of complex numbers. You take a two-dimensional Hilbert space, take an off-diagonal Dirac operator, so just this matrix with some one complex parameter. And then if you look at pure states, you see that this algebra has only two pure states. Call it 0 and 1, or plus and minus, or left and right. So at each point of your spacetime, you have some internal state, which can be 0 or and 1. Or you can look at it, well, I have as if you have two sheets of your spacetime. So this one is for 1, and this one is for 0. And then you know already from the general result that if you want to move on one sheet, then you're fine with that. You have to stay inside of the causal cone. And the question is, can you jump to the other sheet? And the answer turns out to be positive, but you need enough of the proper time. So that's the result. So if you're a photon, then well, your proper time is always 0, so you cannot change your internal state. But if you're a massive particle, it means that you can change your internal state, but you need enough of proper time to do that. Now, the question is it really jumping from one sheet to the other, or is there some continuous process behind it? And there is some continuity here, but then you have to go to mixed states, or a part of mixed states. Is the mixed states of this algebra, they will be just the full interval between 0 and 1. So the whole space between the sheets here, so this kind of a sandwich. And here's the result. If you start at any point here, then you get this formula with arc sine. So if you take 0 and 1, you just get the previous formula. So that would be the picture. So if you start here on one sheet, and you want to stay on this sheet, you can do so. You need to move inside of the cone. And if you want to go up, then it's allowed, but you need to stay under that surface of this cone. Now, the question is it of any good for physics? Well, that's a simple toy model, so shouldn't expect anything special. But some time ago, I came across the phenomenon which is called the Zitterbewegung, the trembling motion of the electron. That's a name coined by Schrödinger in 1930. So very briefly, you can look at it in the following way. If you have a free massive Dirac equation, well, all of the spinors, you can divide them into chirality eigenstates, so left and right-handed. So these are just the eigenstates of the chirality operator. And if you project on this chirality eigenstates the Dirac equation, then you discover that the master mixes the left and the right components. So that's a picture that Roger Penrose draws. And he says that, well, you can look at an electron in the following zigzag way. So it's you can look at this equation as a system of two coupled vial equations, the left-handed being the source for the right-handed, and the right-handed being the source for the left-handed. So an electron would go like that in a zigzag. Then there's another picture by Braut, the one from Braut-Engler-Higgs mechanism. And he was quite fascinated by Kohn's idea of geometry, actually. And that's the two-sheeted spacetime I showed you. And he says that, well, you can look at the electron as being first, moving first on the left sheet and then jumping to the other, then moving and jumping back, and so on and so on. And the funny thing is that if you compute the period of this oscillation in the electron's rest frame, well, you discover this number, pi over m, with some physical constant. And this is just the number we got from our causal structure here. Well, we have a factor 2 because we jump just to one sheet, and that's the full period. So that's just the same number. So that would be the picture that we draw. Says that if you're a massive fermion, a massive fermion is just like a photon, but on a two-sheeted spacetime. So if it has zero momentum, then it would just go like that. If it has some momentum, it would still move on the boundary of the cone, but with some angle here. Okay, so of course this is about classical fermions, say, so point-like particles. But nevertheless, it's quite intriguing that we get the same number and we have the same qualitative viewpoint on a phenomenon which is purely quantum relativistic. So that's quite intriguing. But with non-commutative geometry, you can even go further, and you can consider more general Dirac operators. So you can add an electromagnetic field into the game, and you can add a Yukawa coupling, so a kind of a Higgs-like field. So instead of a constant mass, you have now a scalar field that couples to your fermion. And if you derive the causal structure here, okay, that's another picture from Penrose. He says that, well, typically instead of mass here at the vertices, you actually have an interaction with the Higgs field. So we can compute the causal structure also in this case. And what we see, the first shot, is that there's no impact of the electromagnetic field on this bound of the Zitterbewegung frequency whatsoever. Secondly, this Higgs-like field, this acts as a conformal factor. So it enters the formula. If you don't have this factor here, that's just the formula for the proper time along the causal curve. But if you add this factor, you can see that, well, I can put it under the square root and incorporate it into the metric. And it's just like if that would be a conformal rescaling of my metric. Okay, and we can do it all in a curved spacetime. So anything globally hyperbolic would do. Now, what can we do with that? Can we see that this is the good direction? I hope that we can, but it's not that easy, because for a free electron, this period of Zitterbewegung is 10 to minus 21 seconds. So that's way beyond the limits of the current time resolution. Moreover, as I told you, this is a classical model, and the true electron would certainly require a quantum field theoretic description. That's obvious. But there is a recent domain of called quantum simulation, where people can simulate Dirac particles in some media, for instance, trapped ions or Bose-Einstein condensate or photonics. So they have a quantum system which is effectively described which dynamics is effectively described by a Dirac equation. Two-dimensional so far, but there's also a proposal to do it in four dimensions, an analog four dimensions. And some of these people studied Zitterbewegung, and they discovered this kind of oscillations. That was not surprising because it sits in the Dirac equation. But what we can do with our proposal is that we provide a bound on the frequency of this oscillation, and we can say what might happen if you change your mass into a scalar field, or if you couple an electromagnetic field into the system. So that's something that goes beyond the Dirac equation, and hopefully that can be tested in one of these nice experiments. All right, so let me go towards the conclusions, but let me tell you that, okay, what I have presented you so far is just one very simple model. You can have many other models, gauge models. For instance, you can take this algebra, this 2x2 matrices with a diagonal Dirac operator. Then, well, that's something we also investigated with Nicolas. And then what you get is your almost commutative spacetime. It's just a spacetime component and a qubit, or a sphere, at each point of the spacetime. And again, it turns out that, well, you can move in the spacetime component, well, according to the usual Einstein rules. But if you want to move around the sphere, then you have, again, some speed limit. You cannot go too fast. So that suggests that it's quite a general phenomenon. You can study things which are similar to Zitterbewegung, like neutrino and quark mixing, which are of the same type. You can go more radical. That's a quantum gravity seminar, after all. So let's do something more advanced. You can take a Moyal plane, so an algebra which is generated by these operators, so a non-commutativity of the spacetime. And you can look at a particular subset of all space of states, namely the coherent states. So these are, you can look at them as a kind of smeared events, because they are basically Gaussians that are centered at events of the spacetime, and they have some non-zero spread which is governed by the deformation parameter here. And what Nicolas showed together with Jean-Christophe Houlet from Paris is that using our notion of causality, you discover a rigid causal structure here. So again, you have a nice partial order relation on the space of coherent state of this algebra. So it's again a picture from Penrose's book. He says that, well, there are basically two viewpoints on quantum gravity. One is that you have a spacetime which is still there, and you have a causal order which is somehow in a quantum superposition or whatever indeterminacy. But there's another viewpoint that you can adopt, is that the spacetime itself becomes fuzzy or blurred, but the causal structure is rigid. And this is the picture that we have implemented with the help of our notion of causality. Okay, so finally, let me put a weird idea that maybe can make for a nice project if anyone would be interested. So my idea would be now to go to a quantum field theory, but rethinking the foundations. So say that, well, these local nets of the algebra, to define them, you need a spacetime. But now what we learned from almost commutative geometry is that what you really should look at are the pure states of your algebra, classical algebra. So you should look at the algebras of observables associated with the open regions of this bigger space, almost commutative. So for example, if you say that I have two quantum fields over my spacetime, then you can maybe say that, oh, well, maybe I can have one quantum field, but over this two-sheeted spacetime. What's the consequence of this viewpoint? Well, you say that, but this guy has some intrinsic causal structure which is different than just two copies of these causals, of this causal structure. So this means that the microcausality axiom needs adjustment. And this probably would lead to different algebras of observables. Whether it's a reasonable proposal, I have no idea. But that would be the consequence of our approach. OK, so just take home messages. So I was arguing in favor of an operational viewpoint on physics, and including an operational viewpoint on quantum spacing. So we really have to think in terms of observables and states and what you can measure. What I showed you is that causality is possible in the quantum world. We have a nice partial order relation. Whether it's a good one, I have no idea, but there is one at least. It is there, waiting for you. And finally, that matter does matter. So what we learn from this almost commutative approach is that you really should consider inner degrees of freedom, like color or chirality or whatever, at the same footing as the space-time degrees of freedom. And if you take it seriously, then maybe you can get another viewpoint on quantum field theory. Okay, thank you very much.
Questions?
In the description of Zeta-Bewegung, you said it's governed by the Dirac equation. Mm-hmm. Is that related to the Dirac C picture? Because you said also that the photons do not jump, which may be regarded as they don't have antiparticles.
Zeta-Bewegung is general. There are many viewpoints on Zeta-Bewegung. So the original description of Zeta-Bewegung was all about the position operator. If you look at the position operator in Dirac theory, and you look at its Heisenberg, at it in the Heisenberg picture, then you discover that it fluctuates with time and it quivers. And if you look at the velocity operator in the Heisenberg picture, you see that its expectation value is always plus minus c. So it looks like the electron is moving always at the speed of light. And that's the picture that Penrose draws, that it's the zigzag thing. But the point is that the expectation value of this position operator stops quivering if you take the expectation value of positive energy packets only. So that was the origin of the first explanation, saying that, well, it's about the interference between the positive and the negative parts of the wave packet. But then there are other interpretations, like the chiral interpretation, saying that, well, it's not really about positive and negative energies. It's more about chirality. And you should look at it as governed by the mass. So you need something massive for that to come. There's an analog of the Zeta-Bewegung for bosons, but then you do the Klein-Gordon equation. So that's slightly different. You see, here when I said that if you're a photon, you cannot jump, it's more saying that if your proper time is always zeros, then you cannot change your internal state. But that was not related to the Dirac equation. And in fact, that might be an important point, is that we have a causal structure, so a kinematic structure. Dirac equation is dynamics. So our viewpoint on causality is that any dynamics should be should accord with the kinematic structure of the theory. So if you're able to write down any other theory compatible, which is not governed by the Dirac equation but by something else, then I would claim that it should always also conform to this causal structure that we have derived.
No more questions? Okay, then let's thank the speaker again.